Lee Collins, welcome to Tea Time.
Thank you for having me. Podcast voice.
Oh, yeah, I know, right?
My podcast.
You felt it? You felt it?
Yeah, she felt it. I felt it. I was like, what is happening right now?
Hello.
Yeah, it was a transition. I liked it.
Oh, well, thank you guys.
You're welcome.
Here, now I'm back. Okay, so for everyone who's watching, they know that we usually go into the pot and pull out a topic. But today we're not going to do that because I just want us to fully get into you and your story. And I came across a TikTok video a couple of months back, and it was your beautiful face, and you were telling your story and what happened to you and all of the things that have happened since. And I was instantly locked in. I listened to those TikToks like it was a podcast. I was driving around town just like with my phone playing, and I was just in awe of you. And
I'm going to double down on that. Okay. She would come home and she would be like, have you heard this story? And I'm like, I don't have the same algorithm. What's happening?
I'm on a totally different algorithm. I'm bird talk.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm on cat talk to be 100. And I'm like, babe. She's like, no, we have to get her on the podcast. We have to talk to her. So I'm going to be 100. I don't know your story as well as my wife does.
Okay.
So I want to learn why my wife has fallen in love with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being curious about the story, and thank you for listening to the story. I really appreciate it, and I'm more than happy to share it. It is so interesting. You know, we were just saying, being on TikTok all of a sudden, it's been completely unexpected, the response to the story, the response that women have had to the story. I think I had just kind of had a very specific response from women in my life prior to this that wasn't, you know, like maybe they hadn't gone through something like this. Maybe they couldn't quite relate.
Telling a story that is true to you and yet graphic.
Yeah.
And danger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things that we see on television, really. And having someone as strong as you come to a platform like TikTok and share it unfiltered is, first of all, girl, you got some balls.
Thank you. That's real.
You have balls.
Yeah.
So let's start. Why did you decide to tell your story on TikTok?
That was a culmination of things. I would say the attack itself was 6, almost 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in that time, there was a period of time where the police and the assistant DA that was prosecuting the case asked me to kind of stay out of the press, not talk to the press, not be on social media as visibly, not share a rendition of the story publicly that could potentially, I could be cross-examined about and could confuse the process. So up until 2021, which was when the man who attacked me was sentenced, that was the case. So 2018 to 2021.
Okay.
Then 2021, I think I was kind of like everyone else where I was like, I just want to go out. So I was like trying to regain some normalcy. I think also trying to impress upon everyone around me, like, don't worry, nothing's different. I'm completely the same. In fact, I'm going to be the most perfect version of who I always wanted to be. And then about a year later, early 2022, I kind of just fizzled out because I couldn't keep that up. And it felt like
keep up
a
with
mask.
The Joneses, right?
Right. And so I spent 2 years, like 2022 to 2024, working on. At first, I was writing a screenplay because that felt like something creative and productive that I could do while I was taking this downtime. And then I decided that I wanted to write a book. So I spent that time working on a manuscript, rewriting a manuscript. And it was really nice, honestly, taking a couple of years just to be quiet and reset my relationships and reset my boundaries and work on myself. And I don't think I could have maybe gone into telling the story as authentically or as raw or as real. You know, I would have done a performative version of it that I thought everyone wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And it took that time to kind of start to peel these layers back. And I think that process is still happening. Even we had a call when you first reached out where you caught me on something that I was kind of fawning.
Yes.
And was saying, you know, I don't have to say all the scary stuff. Yeah. I can hold that back.
Yeah.
And you checked me and said, you don't have to hold anything back here. This is a safe space to say anything that's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also,
and thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And what you were also doing was kind of saying, I don't want to trigger, I don't want to, you know, potentially upset someone else, which I respected you for that. I understand what you're, you know, I understood what you were saying, but at the same time, what I was trying to say to you was you have every right to say your story and what you're feeling or what you were thinking. And if it does trigger someone else, ultimately it's not your responsibility to take care of that individual's trigger.
And I think that's the key to it, is responsibility for someone else's emotional safety.
But also very much your personality.
Right. And like my childhood and all that.
It's funny because my mom, my parents, they used to scare me into being good by showing me stories and telling me stories that were obviously very triggering to keep me from doing certain things.
Like things to be afraid of.
Exactly.
The extremes.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I'd love to go back. Just let's start Lee 15, 16. Was she... Did she have as big balls as you do now? Like,
I love this. I'm like so flattered that I have these big balls.
She needs big ovaries, okay? Come on.
Well, both of them.
She's got them. 15, 16, I was really, really rebellious. And that's such an interesting question because it's something I've explored in healing and then in writing this story, because I think it's really about self-discovery at the end of the day, like really learning who you are and uncovering who you really are. I think at 15 or 16, I was very rebellious. I felt very stuck in the small town that I lived in. I didn't see an example of anyone that I wanted to be or a life that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time in books and in movies. And I watched Nick at Night a lot. Mm-hmm. So like I actually, the one celebrity that I met that I started crying was Dick Van Dyke. I cried and I ran to the car.
Where did you meet Dick Van Dyke? I'm so jealous.
I know. It was such a treasure.
I used to watch Nick at Night all the time.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah. And he was everything on Nick at Night. He was like this mythic figure. He had like a little, I think it was maybe his birthday party in 2016. His wife threw him a little birthday party at like the Malibu Playhouse. Mm. And he was meeting people and hugging people. And I literally cried and ran.
Oh my God.
Didn't get to hug him.
That's exactly what happened with me and Janet. I cried and ran.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
You
the very just first like, time.
Did you go back?
No. And then I went back like years later and I was like, I'm
it took that long.
Sorry. Can I have another one?
Wait, I'm really jealous that you guys both have had celebrity encounters where you cried and ran, because I have never met a person who's like brought that much emotion to me.
I feel like for everyone there's one person and it's a surprise.
Okay, maybe it'd be a surprise.
Yeah. I think you cry and run from the sweet potatoes in the grocery store when they're not your favorite.
Yeah, but that's out of like sheer frustration and anger, not like love and adoration. Yeah, exactly. And like every other day at Erewhon, babe.
I'm trying to find your one.
I'm like, I kind of feel like maybe it would be J-Lo.
Oh, for sure.
But I don't think I'd cry and run. I think I would just be like, holy shit, she's real.
And everyone processes differently.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
exactly. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, I appreciate
okay,
that.
Okay, so you were rebellious in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And
eating cheese curds
all day. Yeah. The squeaky kind.
Oh my God, the best
just
kind.
The
and you couldn't find anybody to really look up to model your life after. Where was the choice to go for after high school? What did you choose to do?
I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was where my mom went, and I went for a political theory because my mom told me I should be a lawyer, and she's
thanks,
probably going to listen to this podcast. So
Hi, Mom.
Love you.
Hi to all our moms.
Hi, Mom.
Good. But a couple of years into college, I decided to switch and go to art school in Chicago.
Oh, fine art?
Fine art, and did performance art and did theater and made short films with friends and sang backup vocals for my friends' songs.
Oh, awesome.
And painted, and it was just wonderful. It was amazing. And I loved Chicago as a city. And from there, I moved home, saved up money in like a wooden box for 2 years, waitressing.
Love it.
I saved up, I think, $1,500 cash. And then my mom matched me. She gave me $1,500.
Thank you, Mom.
Thanks, Mom. She's like, you better tell them when. But then I drove out here with Cookie, my dog, who I still have.
Yeah.
This is in 2011. And like didn't have any place to live, found a little studio in Venice, like a little one room.
And what was the goal coming out here? What was the goal?
I knew I wanted to do something like in the arts.
Okay.
And that just wasn't an option where I was from, really. Like I ended up going to school and finishing in graphic design. And if you worked in graphic design in my hometown, you worked in a factory. So I went to a couple of interviews to get factory jobs, and it just was not really what I was imagining as far as like the creativity. And so I came out here, and my first job ended up being I like convinced a recruiter to let me interview for an assistant job at CAA.
Yes.
And they like hired me as a graphic designer, and they gave me an office, and they gave me my own assistant. And it was like,
oh my God.
Oh my God, my dreams are coming.
Follow your dreams. Amazing. Look what happened.
And it was like, they wouldn't give me the factory job, but then CAA, they told me I wasn't good enough for the factory job. And then CAA was like, we like you. There's something about you that we like.
Well, that's also the industry.
Right. Also, like, exactly. You seem doe-eyed and innocent.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. She's a pretty girl. Let's go.
Yeah. So from there, I ended up, you know, building a career in kind of like design for entertainment brands and working kind of behind the scenes for like creators and filmmakers and things like that, which has been really great.
And what city were you living in at that time?
Living in L.A., so 2011 moved to Venice, and then from there was living in Santa Monica in this little walk up where this attack ended up happening for, I think, about how long? 5-6 years.
Okay.
For a while. So can you take us back to the time and this, can you take us back to the time around the attack and tell us about this attack?
I like want to also acknowledge people always, and there's nothing wrong with it, people always want to dive into, tell me about the second he was in your home.
I don't want to know that yet.
And I love that the both of you have asked me questions about like kind of your setting life. The stage for, who I am beyond that. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, so before you answer her question, I have another question before we get to the attack.
Okay.
So you're in Santa Monica, sorry.
I was just trying to segue because she said in the walk up where the attack happened. I was like, yeah, it was a good segue.
It was a good segue, but I have one more question. So you're just in L.A. by yourself with your dog?
I had a boyfriend that I moved here with.
Okay.
And he kind of plays a part in, not in the act of violence of the attack, but plays a role in the story. So I'd been dating him for 2 months or something in Wisconsin, and I was essentially just like a free ride for him to get out here.
Yummy. And so when
not yummy. I know this.
He was super attractive.
I don't know the story. Oh, okay, listen, it's a free ride to LA, dude. Get your shit in order. Okay. So you're living with him in this place in Santa Monica.
He and I moved out here. We're together for like six, 7 months. And I'll explain why there's like a tie.
Yeah.
And then I ultimately was living in this apartment in Santa Monica just with Cookie. And I had a foster dog at the time.
Okay. And you felt safe.
Very safe. Safe
in this space.
I did.
And Santa Monica, for those who don't know, it's a nice,
it's a suburb. Yeah.
it's a nice lease. You know what I mean? You're not, you know, paying chump change for it.
Yeah.
There are definitely pockets that are very bougie and harder to get into, and then there are areas that are a bit seedy.
Most definitely.
Where you want to be a little bit more conscious.
Yeah. But my apartment that I was in, it was like rent controlled, so it was really, really cheap. Okay. And it was old. It was built in the 60s, but it was a 2-bedroom. I had a little yard that was somewhat shared with other tenants, but I could have a garden. I could let Cookie play out in the yard.
Yeah. Idealistic.
Yeah. And then it was 2 blocks away from the ocean, and it was so cheap. So I was like, I can never leave
cake
by the ocean. But it was it was underneath a bus stop and right next to the 10 freeway, where the 10 meets the ocean. But also the Santa Monica High School was there, which gave me a sense of security and safety. And the police station was right there. Okay. So it was like...
So you were kind of close to Main Street.
Very. Okay. In between like the 10 off-ramp, which is the freeway, and then Main Street, the beginning
of
Main Street.
So were you going to Earth Cafe?
Yeah, all the time.
Me too.
Were you?
Wait, so what year was this?
This was 2018.
Okay.
Well, 2013 to 2018, I lived
Well, there was a period of overlap there because I was working at a hair salon on Main Street called Art Luna.
Oh, I know that one.
And it was like it looked like a house. And he converted it. And so I used to get my hair done there as a
kid.
Next
to the dog park, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I used to get my hair done there as a kid. And then after I graduated from high school, I decided to go to SMCC, but I couldn't stand SMCC. So I started hanging out at the hair salon all day. And they were like, you're here so much, Miranda. They're like, do you just want to work at the front desk? So I was like, yeah, absolutely. But I would spend my days there and basically at Earth Cafe getting like food orders for everyone. So I'm sure
it's a really small little neighborhood. There were a couple of restaurants that I worked at, like M Street Cafe.
Yes, exactly.
I worked at back in the day.
We're like to 2013. You said from 2013 to 2018, this is the apartment that you lived in.
Yeah.
Just setting the stage. Beautiful young girl out in L.A., getting her whole life, dream job at one of the agencies. Her dog is underneath her shoulder. I don't know if she's fluffy or not. She could have been fluffy at the time.
Boyfriend.
Who's yummy. I don't know. I like girls. And TBD. I feel...
Can't relate.
And then the world cracks. I know a little bit, and I don't want to jump because I also want to make it in sequential order, but were you at any point before the actual attack ever spidey sensey about who was in your neighborhood? Did you ever look over your shoulder at times? Were you one of those girls like I am that has to get in before nighttime and lock all the doors?
Do you worry about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. My mom scared the shit out of me at a very young age, yeah. Just because of what I am and who I am, as well as that I'm a female.
Yeah.
And I had multiple firearms in my house. I had two-way locks and two-way mirrors. And my mom put bars on all of my windows to where I was like, Mom, I feel like I'm a caged bird. She's like,
There's a line.
Yeah. But what about
yours?
You
was super extra. Mine, just really quickly, because I wasn't a famous person. I didn't have a mom who freaked me out in that way, but I always had that anxiety of something happening, which is why I think in hearing your story, I was kind of like, I couldn't take myself away from it, but I was also like, this is my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
This is something that every time I'm alone, I kind of think about, I'm really hypervigilant. So to hear it play out in your words and know that it was your real experience, I mean, it was kind of mind-blowing to me. But yeah, were you someone who Spidey checked over her shoulders?
It is so interesting. I think there's like this kind of attack in the like civilizations that we live in now is one of our great, it's akin to like a snake or like a lion, you know, like it's kind of like a natural evolution of that fear of being preyed upon by someone, you know, like that's someone that wants to hurt you and, you know, that you don't have control over the situation. So I think it's natural to have that fear. I like looking back at that time, I was not getting a sense that I was being watched. I also like, I've had a couple women ask me if I left my blinds and my curtains open in my apartment, because there was a vantage point that you could see, like you would be able to look into my apartment and be undetected from the bus stop above. And I, for like 2 years, refused to put curtains on those windows, kind of almost in an act of defiance, like I'm just sitting on my couch, you know, like why is anyone watching? And now I don't know, but I would assume that someone was. And so something I always say too, that is just really important to me, is with my story, like the way that I tell it, I think it could be wielded as kind of like weaponizing fear a little bit. But what I really want everyone to take away from it is to be prepared not to like escalate anyone's
fear. there is a bit of healthy fear that people should have.
Yeah.
And I think there's there's anxiety fear where it's like, calm down. But then there's like the fear that I have.
Of like, I'm sitting on my couch saying like, come get me.
I'm invincible.
It's the invincibility.
And also not believing that anyone would ever want to hurt you. I think a little bit of gullibility.
Exactly.
Too. It's hard to wrap your mind around the idea of it really happening to you, which again is
that.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Okay,
it's an age thing. It's an age thing, too. How old were you during this moment?
I thank the universe that I was 32.
Okay.
The news reported that I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
I was
she's
in her 20s.
Okay. So now take us to
my wife is like, tell me what happened.
Yeah. I love it.
I'm enjoying the whole story.
Telling the story.
This is the whole story. I know. So take us, and there's so many different parts of it, and I want to make sure we give space to all of it. So take us to that night.
So one thing that I want to make sure I say that was kind of confusing in the way that I said it, but was I had a boyfriend for a little while that came out with me from Wisconsin, but then leading up to the attack, I was dating someone, because this is a character that plays a role later. I was dating someone for 5 years on and off.
You were doing two dates at the same time?
I know. That's when everyone's like, okay, which boyfriend?
Yes.
Like, but no, I
was 22.
She's 22. She's like Karen the world. She's working at CAA. Yes. She's actually the president of CAA. She has two boyfriends, and she's thriving.
All these boyfriends that came with her today.
Exactly. Exactly.
But no, I was dating someone. It was like an on and off rocky relationship, roller coaster relationship. And he was someone that I like went to school with in high school, and we had moved out to California separately. But we had been in this relationship for 5 years that I didn't realize at the time was as damaging as it was. And then this, and I wouldn't have
damaging in what way?
I wouldn't have said that it was an emotionally abusive relationship unless this had happened, because then like
this
he doubles
attack?
Down this attack.
Okay.
Because then he doubles down on some of the emotional manipulation that was happening and escalates it to a place that I do categorize as abuse.
Oh, let's go, honey. Let me take my earrings off. Tell me what's okay. up.
I could see your eyebrows all of a
all
sudden
down,
go.
All yeah. around. Let's
like,
go.
No, no, no.
Yeah, because you also talk so much about, and again, this is what I'm saying. There's so many layers to this, and you've broken it down in so much detail, but about narcissists and toxic relationships, and there's just huge conversations at peace. But to yeah. get there, we have to
do a timeline.
We have to yeah. start at so, the night the of night. The attack.
So what day is it?
It's Thursday evening.
Okay, Thursday evening.
Thursday afternoon, I like went and got my hair cut. I was freelancing at that time. I no longer was working for CIA. I was working just kind of freelance projects. And I went to go get my hair cut, and I was supposed to go out with my ex. We mm-hmm. were supposed to go to a party in West Hollywood. He told me he had never agreed to that. We got into a fight, and then I went home, made dinner, sat on the couch, went to bed.
Okay.
Normal night, 10 p.m., went to bed. I had my dog and then a little foster dog, same size, like 15 pounds at the time, and went to bed, woke up at like, I think, 2:45 mm-hmm. because the dogs were barking. And that was not out of the ordinary. You know, they're both little dogs, so it wasn't yeah. like they're going to get someone, but they were alerting me to something. I was annoyed, got them to be quiet, kind of peeked outside to see if anyone was outside. No one was out there, so I went back to sleep. Maybe, I think 15 minutes later, I know it was 3:04 when I woke up, but I think it was about 15 minutes later I woke up again, and I could tell immediately that their barking was different, that their barking was panicked. Mm-hmm. And it was, as soon as I woke up, I could just kind of feel the shift. And I got sat up, went to get my phone off the nightstand, looked at the phone, and it was 3:04 a.m.
Okay.
When I looked up, like I had just rearranged my room so that the bed, that day, so that the bed was facing the doorway, which you're actually not supposed to do.
Yeah, it's feng shui. No,
it's
no.
Feng shui bad. And I was under a window, which
feng
is also
shui
bad.
Bad.
All my energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Real bad.
It's okay. bad.
And, but I like the good thing about this is that I had this vantage point of
True.
The door, because there were twinkle lights on in the living room. So there was kind of ambient light coming in. And as I was looking up from my phone, I saw the silhouette of a figure kind of peek in.
What the?
And then peek out. But I couldn't see their face. So that, again, is like a nightmare.
Yes.
It's like, that's when you're a little kid, you see a yeah. silhouette, and you think you see it, but you're not sure, and you talk yourself out of it.
Yeah.
Nightmare.
And you did. You tried to talk yourself out of it at that time. 100%. Okay. 100%. And did you get back under the covers? Did you?
I could feel my body start to tense up and, like, my breath. You know, I think physiologically my body was getting ready.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I said, it's probably my ex. He's probably trying to scare me. We got into this fight earlier. He has a key.
Got it.
But also, I've told other women this, and they're like, how fucked up that your ex would scare you like that.
Yeah.
And you would think,
yeah. men do that.
Like, but
on.
Men do that.
Men do
so
that
I was like,
time.
He probably has a Frosty. He's sitting on the couch.
Not a Frosty.
Yeah. Oh, Frosties all day. So I was like, I'm about to get a Frosty. But also I was physiologically reacting
yes,
to
yeah.
this
like
energy
you
in
knew.
My space.
Yeah.
I had a hunting knife that a friend from Wisconsin had given me in my underwear drawer. It was like a really complicated thing.
Switch thingies.
So I left it. I also left my phone because I kept telling myself, You're gonna look so stupid when it's him. You're gonna really, you know, like he's gonna make fun of you when
can I stop you
right overreact.
Now? Can I stop you right now?
Sure.
I lived with Lindsay Lohan back in 20 something. And
you
she
can
was
see
never there.
And where this is, you can see why
this is very important
yeah.
to the story. I used to live with Lindsay Lohan, but she was never there, right? She was
yeah.
always working because it was like the height of her fame. And one day, somebody knocked on the door. I was by myself.
She'll be offended. Yeah.
She was at the height of her fame.
I know, but
it's like Freaky Friday days.
Yeah.
It's like huge.
She's like, she'd be like, well, I just did Freaky Friday too, bitch.
I'm just kidding.
She's like, I'll never pee.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So,
knock at the door.
She's knocking on the door, and I'm by myself. Bitch, let me tell you, I got a vase the size of her and went to the door.
Yes.
And opened the door. And she's like, what are you doing? I said, I don't know you. You haven't been in this house.
That is correct.
It was Lindsay.
But that is correct.
But hilarious. I literally will not leave my room without some kind of weapon. Because why were you afraid to be embarrassed to hold that?
But this goes
matters
more. But here's the deal that I'm just going to interject on your behalf. This is what leads back to the people pleasing, the thing we were talking about earlier.
Okay,
there's a personality. Yeah, there's personality energy here that is impacting
for
a little bit of it.
But definitely, and he, you know, he was a figure that I had. Oh, in my mind that he was so in control of what was okay and what wasn't.
Understood.
As far as my behavior. But also, I think a lot of us talk ourselves out of things. Like, our intuition will tell us something.
Yeah.
And then cognitively, we will tell ourselves a different story.
Most
and 100%. I feel like our intuition always knows. Also, I really love the vase, because that's something that I say to women too, because I've got a lot of feedback from primarily men that have seen me, like, in boxing, which mm-hmm. I do now. Back then, I had no fight training of any kind or self-defense training. Men will see me boxing now and be like, you're not that great at boxing. And I'm like, no shit.
Go sit down.
That's not what saved me was boxing.
Right. Yeah.
What saved me was adaptability and ferocity.
That part.
Yeah. You know? So
ferocity.
Like finding a weapon wherever there's a weapon and being ferocious.
Anything can be a
with
weapon.
With no tools.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So the weird figure tips his head in the door. Tips
now
back
you've
out.
Left your room.
You've yeah. not picked up the knife. You've not picked up your phone. You think your boyfriend's in the other room with a chocolate frosty and some fries.
That's right.
Let's go forward.
So I'm in like little pajamas, like little shorts.
Cute.
And a little t-shirt. My hair's up in a bun. And I walk out through the living room. There's no one there. Walk out through the dining room. There's no one there. Walk into the kitchen. And
did
I
you turn
up.
On any lights?
No.
Fair.
And
keep
I don't
going.
Remember if I said anything either. If I
okay.
said hello. Is anybody there? I don't remember.
Sorry. Continue.
But I felt like I was being like drawn. Like, and I do remember feeling almost like an energy field impact
mm-hmm.
when I was in the dining room, where all of a sudden I started to feel more afraid, like, what's happening? And then I walked into the kitchen and I looked up, and there was a man standing with his back flush up against the wall, and he had one of my knives that I recognized from my knife
kitchen
set,
knife
a kitchen knife, and I thought it was a paring knife, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't, but I'm glad I thought that, in his hand, and it was black blade, black handle. And I just remember thinking, it was like a different voice took over.
Yeah.
And this voice said, this is, you don't know this person, this is a nightmare person. Like, I remember that voice saying, this is a nightmare
yeah.
person. And that voice said, you need to look him up and down, you need to remember everything that you can so that
mm-hmm.
you can identify him later. So I was like, okay, he's tall, he's wearing a hoodie, he has a goatee, he has a long face, he's wearing jeans, he's wearing work boots.
Mm-hmm.
Or I thought he was wearing work boots. And then I ran backwards, because it was like time slowed down. That was a fraction of a second
right.
where I was clocking this list that I would hope I would use later. And then I didn't think about running for the door. I just moved away as fast as I
yeah.
could. So I
yeah.
was running backwards like this. And then I was screaming, like, you know, like, ah, somebody help me, help me.
Yeah.
And I remember like feeling water from a vase splash on the back of my legs, because there was a vase of flowers on the coffee table.
Okay.
So I like launched myself up and over the coffee table and was pushing my back, like got up on the couch and was pushing my back up against the window, like trying to push the wall down
yes.
almost. And he ran. I remember seeing him like crouch low and like running fast. And he ran toward me, caught up to me on the couch, jumped on the couch to my side. Held the knife to my throat right here and said, like, kind of whispered, like, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. I'm going to fucking kill you. You see, I have a knife, right? I'm going to fucking kill you. Then I went into like, okay, well, I'm going to befriend this guy so much that he's going to want to let me go. I'll
yeah,
humanize
yeah,
myself.
Yeah.
Because I've always heard those stories and respected that so much. That's so brilliant
mm-hmm.
to convince them to be on your side.
Yeah.
And speaking of Anna Kendrick's movie, Woman of the Hour, that Have you guys seen it?
Not yet.
There's a scene where there's like that in its most brilliant form. Mm-hmm.
I often think that that would be my approach too, if something like this were to ever happen to me, where I would try and humanize myself to this person and connect with them in some way. But who knows if in the moment I'd be able to or not.
I mean, it works. You know, like we've seen cases where that's worked and it's an effective strategy. Like to me, that's like fight, flight, freeze, fawn. Yeah. To me, sound mm-hmm. a little kind of sing-songy and silly the way that they're phrased. But fawning is like outsmarting your attacker. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, like to think, to emotionally manipulate them into letting you go
yeah.
is mastermind, you know, level mm-hmm. of being able to navigate someone's psyche.
Totally.
So I think I've spoken to a lot of women too that have said like that would be exactly where I would go to be to try to convince him to let me go.
What did you say?
So I just tried to be as agreeable as possible and answer his questions, and also tried to everything that I said back to him. It was really short answers, but I tried to position him as an authority mm-hmm. and me as a friend. That you know, like you can trust me, things like that. But he said, shut the fuck up. So I stopped screaming. The knife was always at my throat and he was right here. I remember like feeling him breathing. And I was trying to like get a sense of like, does he seem like he's not present? Mm-hmm. You know, does he seem like he's like in a state, you know, whether that's mental illness or like drug induced. And he didn't. He seemed super clear. He seemed like anxious, like anticipation.
Adrenaline,
but excited.
Yeah.
That was like the feeling that he was giving me on this like arm. And then he said, do you have a boyfriend? And that scared
me.
You're
like seven.
Yeah, they're all coming.
They're all coming with Frosty, so you got to go.
Yeah, me. Just wait.
Are you okay with me? I'm...
Please.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
I came out victorious in this story, so I love telling it.
Okay.
I do sometimes get like, you might see me like tense up physically.
I see you shaking.
It's okay.
Bit.
Yeah.
I see you.
But that it like...
That's why I like to laugh.
And exactly. That, okay. Like I can always see, like always with other women, that they can see that I'm saying my words with my mouth, but I'm physically having a reaction. And sometimes they'll be like, okay, like, let's just chill.
Okay, good.
You know? But I appreciate it.
Okay.
But so he asked if I had a boyfriend, and I said, yes, of course, everyone would.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, what time did he leave? And I said, 10. And he went from feeling tense to not feeling tense. And so I was like, I've said something wrong. You know, like, how does he know that he didn't leave at 10? So that was something that I remember noting.
Okay.
Like, he seems relaxed when I say that. And I was disappointed with my answer. Like, damn. You know, like, mm-hmm, that sucks. Mm-hmm. Then he said, where's the fucking money? And I remember thinking, it's 2018. I have, like, a debit card and a credit card.
Yeah,
like, I don't have, like a vault of cash.
Right.
Or a safe. So... he said he wanted money, and I was like, I don't have any cash. I have, like, computers. I have a camera, like, anything you want. I'll give you anything you want. So he told me to stand up, and he stood behind me, and he was careful to try to get me to not see his face at that point, but he wasn't wearing a mask. I also didn't know how he had gotten in at that point. Mm. I remember thinking, like, how did he get in?
Because
the door wasn't wide open or anything. And he...
Can I pause you?
Sure.
Where are the dogs?
The dogs were hiding, thank God.
Okay.
Keep going. Like, it was almost like they could sense...
something was wrong.
There was a time for them to hide and be small.
That's crazy.
And I'm so glad that they did that, because that would have been such an effective... And I'm cautious to even ever say that either, because who knows who's listening.
Yeah. In regards to...
Like, if he were to take Cookie, my little dog...
Like,
and
you
threaten her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a tool against me. You know,
yes,
that would get
most
me
definitely.
To be very compliant.
Yeah.
But they were hiding.
Okay.
But he, like, kind of pushed me forward, and he put his arm around me, like his bicep around me, and had the knife right here, and then held my bun with the other hand. And he kind of pushed me forward, and he pushed me first into my bedroom. And I remember the light switch at the time didn't control the light, just the fan, and so he told me to switch it on. I tried explaining that, and he just said, turn it on. So I turned it on, and it got really cold, and I just remember thinking, I want to get out of here. Like, I don't want him to be in my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like how this feels. And all of a sudden, my brain extracted information and said, there's $31, or there's money in this nightstand in the guest room. And I said, I remember there's cash. And so he moves me over to the guest room door, which was closed. And he said, he like stopped and said, if you're lying to me and if there's someone in there, I'll fucking kill you and I'll fucking kill them. Are you lying to me? And that's where I said, of course, I'm not lying to you. Like, you're in charge. I would never lie to you. You can trust me. And so we went in. I found the $31, passed it back to him. And then he said, now what else do you have for me? And that was when I realized, like, up to that point, I thought maybe, like, there was an outreach center across from where I lived that was, like, would feed unhoused people. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I was thinking, like, maybe he just saw the lights on and it looked like a cozy house and he didn't know there was a girl
here. You're making excuses for him,
right? I was, emotionally going into what's mm-hmm. going on with him. When he said, what else do you have for me? There was a shift.
I was going to say, also in your mind, too, you probably at that point were just trying to hope that this wasn't going to go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And to go as bad as it could go, you know?
Exactly.
I can understand that.
Exactly. And I, like, all of that hope when he said that shot down and out of me. That, like, that hope was gone. I could feel what he was saying and how serious he was mm-hmm. about saying it. So then I started to cry. And he, like, pushed me. And this... disclaimer, trigger warning. This is when it gets into more like assault.
Yeah.
So then he pushes me back into my room and it's really cold from the fan. And he told me to put my hands up against the wall and he stood behind me and I'm sobbing, snot, you know, like not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
And he took his left hand, kept the knife right here and was feeling like under my shirt and making moaning sounds. So then I'm sobbing and I just kept repeating, you don't have to do this. I'm a nice person. You don't have to do this. I'm a nice person. You don't have to do this. I'm a nice person. Because I thought maybe that would matter.
Like breakthrough. Yeah.
Yeah. To break through and make me a human, or the crying would break through and make me a human. And it didn't.
And those were those are things that oftentimes will excite.
The other
I was just
way.
About yeah. to say it.
They
it
will excite or like,
that's excitable. People,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's prey.
Was it exciting?
It's
him?
Prey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I did feel, he moved me over to the bed, told me to stretch out my arms and legs because I like curled up in a ball at first. And he said, stretch out your legs and stretch out your arms and touch the thing when the thing was the headboard. And I'm still crying and I'm so vulnerable then. Like,
completely.
Completely like, vulnerable. I've got all my clothes on, but I was completely like belly up. And he stood on the side of the bed and he told me to face the wall away from him. And he held the knife right here. And he was like rubbing over my shorts and moaning. And then I like time slowed down so much, you know, like when your adrenaline is that high and your body is that in tune, like maybe it was 15 seconds, 20 seconds that this was happening before he said he wanted to get up on the bed. But the amount of thoughts that I had in that time was incredible. Yeah. You know, I talk about in the TikToks that I saw like what potentially could be a future. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not a mother. I don't have any children, but I saw a daughter. I saw holding a daughter. I saw her dancing at her wedding. And I was an old woman sitting in a chair. It was like a vision.
Yeah.
It's interesting what the brain does in moments of scary situations. You know, there's a lot of people that go through abuse as children. Mm-hmm. Horrid abuse. Mm-hmm. And they disassociate mm-hmm. to such a point where multiple personality disorder becomes. 100%. And, you know, you are disassociating to save yourself. And mm-hmm. your brain, just up to this point, is so intriguing to me because your brain told you, remember what this man looks like?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's giving you all the necessary things. It's split. And it's amazing. We haven't finished a story, but I'm going to give you kudos now that it came back together and you didn't stay split.
That's interesting.
Because sometimes in moments you can stay split. I'm sure you have some side effects.
And even float out.
And float out.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have side effects because if you didn't, then you really do have some crazy balls. But like your brain saved you.
But it's also the amazingness of the human brain and what the brain will do. And I want
to
get back.
It knows you need to be inspired.
Yeah.
It knows that you need to overcome.
Like, this is your
fear
future.
Is physically crippling.
Yes.
Yeah. You know? But also our primal response is to survive. Like, if you see any animal in the wilderness that feels as though it's being attacked or it's become prey suddenly, you are just, every mechanism in your body is going to survival mode. Mm-hmm. Another thing about your brain that you mentioned in this moment of seeing your future daughter, an old woman at the wedding, was a Dexter moment. Can you talk about that?
Oh, shit, not Dexter.
Did you watch Dexter?
No, I
you
didn't.
You didn't?
No, I didn't. But also, you had a really...
episode.
Okay, because I was going to... Just tell us. Tell us.
Okay. So I was not like a super fan of Dexter, but I loved Dexter. You know, like I watched the whole series mm-hmm. all the way through to the end. I also watched the other one that came out.
6 Feet Under?
Oh, the well, I love Michael C. Hall and Six yeah. Feet Under yeah, very
the second
much.
One he did, yeah.
Yes, but I did watch the second one he did. But there was a scene that I didn't remembering. Right. From Dexter.
I thought this was so interesting.
First, I saw my daughter dancing at her wedding, and all of this is happening while I'm looking at the wall. I also saw, like, my dad, my brothers, my then ex-boyfriend guy who was in my life who lived less than a mile away, saw all of them, like, breaking down the wall. Like, not yeah. coming in the door, the wall crumbled, and it was just brick, and they came in, and they grabbed me out of the dark, and they pulled me out by the arms. Mm. And there was a realization also in that that's not going to happen. Mm, so that I remember that was like this beautiful warm vision accompanied by a chill. And I, like a chill that I can still kind of feel like mm-hmm. at the base of my spine. Mm-hmm. That's like,
that's all of your nervous system.
No one's coming for you.
Your
yeah.
system.
Yeah. But again, like a beautiful vision that also reminds you, you need to do that for yourself.
Yeah.
You know? Like if I had stayed stuck in that vision and stayed in that hope that's so unlikely, I wouldn't have done what I did.
Yeah.
But so then I all of a sudden saw this vision of this scene from Dexter, and it's, you know, Dexter's like always getting caught by other serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was like the tree trimmer killer. I don't remember. But he was a serial killer that was always getting caught by other serial killers. And he once again was caught. He was tied down on a table. And again, I don't remember thinking that this scene was remarkable, but my brain stored it.
Yeah.
Apparently for this. He, in his like voiceover that he does in the show, Dexter says, a wolf in a trap will chew off its own leg to survive. Its survival instinct is that strong, and so is mine. And he rocks the table so that it tips over. You remember the scene?
I remember that.
So that it tips over and breaks his own arm so that he can pull it out of the strap, and then he's free. Mm-hmm. So he sacrificed his arm mm-hmm. to escape. And then he attacks this guy, and, you know, then he's fine. So I remember thinking, a wolf in a trap will chew off its own leg to survive. A wolf in a trap will chew off its own leg to survive. And imagining that... if he attacks me with this knife, and of course, everyone's so afraid of getting cut by a knife, thinking how bad it will hurt. I'll tell you guys, but it didn't hurt at all, which is interesting. Mm. Again, the brain and the body mm-hmm. and how it saves you.
Yeah.
But I imagined he's going to come at me with the knife, and I'll hold up my arms, and I'll lose potentially both my arms, but I'll still have my heart.
Yeah.
And I'll still survive. And maybe it will scare him so much, all the blood and me attacking him and the gore, and be so unexpected that he'll leave me alone. Mm. So I made that bargain in my mind that I would give up my arms to survive. And so he told me then to turn on my side, because I was still... like
belly
arms
up,
legs down, but turned face. So I like went to turn my body, and he went to get up on the bed. And as he did that, I could feel his erection on my leg. So this was like getting him more excited, me crying. Mm-hmm. And then he pulled the knife away from my neck for a second, just a second. And I screamed, "Somebody fucking help me!" as loud as I could. And then within, it was just a flash. It was like, he's on top of, he was straddling me on top of me. We were fighting like arms, like, foo, 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 you know, just like a flurry of arms. I remember punching his, his zipper on his pants and trying to push the zipper into his skin.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone tells me you're supposed to punch the balls. I was not aware of that. I wish
yeah,
I was.
Yeah, the balls are the ones that are
the sensitive. I should have gone for the balls. Yeah. I was like trying to dig the zipper into his skin. And then I saw a white light. And it was like white light, white light, white light. And I realized he's punching you, And he, luckily, he doesn't punch that hard, I remember thinking. But I think he was punching with his left, which I think he's right-handed, but also barely felt like anything. Mm-hmm. Felt like nothing. Good. Yeah, thank God for adrenaline. Mm-hmm. And I was like, he can punch you 100 times, but you have to stay awake. If you fall asleep, you die. So if he punches you 100 times, fine. At least he doesn't punch that hard, was what I thought. And then I felt bop, bop in my head. And I remember thinking he was hitting me with the butt of the knife because it felt dull. And I was thinking, like, why would he hit me with the butt of the knife? That doesn't make sense. And while all this was happening, I got my legs up underneath him and kicked him off of me. So he fell off to the side of the bed, the other side of the bed. Mm-hmm. And I shot up, and I still have, like, a somatic, I guess.
Response?
Yeah, like mm-hmm. a... Like a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a tick.
Okay.
Where I'll, when I'm anxious, sometimes I'll pull my face away to the right, which was how I was pulling away from
now.
Him.
Now. Understood.
Got it. Or I'll shoot up like.
Yes, you'll have.
I was free.
Your CPTSD moment reaction mm-hmm. that gets triggered even till this day.
Exactly. Understood. That's the kind of my body trapped in these moments yeah. of like pulling away from him and then being free for the first time.
Yeah.
Because I've never had anyone control my body like that.
Yeah.
That him holding me like that and moving me like a doll was the scariest thing
yeah.
in the world to not have any control.
Except for the fact that he's hitting you on the forehead with the butt of the knife.
Well, it wasn't the butt. Yeah. So he's down on the ground and he's looking at his hands, and I didn't, and he had like was sitting, had his knees up, and he was looking down at his hands, and I sit up like, because I'm free.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel myself get cut while we were fighting, but I kind of instinctively held up my left hand and saw that my ring finger and my pinky finger had been almost severed. And so they're just kind of like dripping blood onto comforter. And I saw that, and I felt, it went from feeling terrified to feeling enraged.
Hell yeah, you're about to whoop this.
It was exactly that. It was just like, I'm going to fucking kill you. Yes,
mama bear's out here in these streets.
Well, also, exactly. It's like, how fucking dare you, right?
Yeah, like, well, you see it, and it's evidence of how far he'll go.
Yeah.
He cares nothing for your body. He cares nothing for your life. There's nothing precious about you bleeding. Like, it was like, I've said before, it's like he broke a human contract.
Mm,
but I was like, you broke a human contract, and now I'm going to fucking kill you.
Let's go. What's next, girl? So, let's get him. I'm ready for it.
She's ready. I'm so glad you're right there.
I'm right here.
You're about to be so satisfied.
Yes!
Yeah, you are.
I'm ready, girl.
He's down looking at his hands, and I found out why later he was looking at his hands. But I looked down at him, and I looked at my hand, and I looked down at him. And the door was right there, but I screamed at him, you cut my fucking fingers off. You cut my fucking fingers off. I'm going to fucking kill you.
Yes. Yes, bitch. It's called ring it around.
Let's go.
So
then I jumped down and I started punching him. Like my left hand was fucked up, obviously, but my right hand, I'm punching him. I'm kicking him. I'm screaming at him. Get the fuck out of my house. I'm going to fucking kill you. Get the fuck out of my house. And he was still on the ground then, but then
better stay on the ground.
Wait, do you know where the knife is at this point?
He still has the knife.
Okay.
I stuck my fingers in his eye and up his nose and been like, taste it.
So he had the knife on the ground. I'm punching and kicking and screaming at him.
Just this part, the white light was actually him stabbing her forehead. He wasn't punching.
So the white light was punching, but the butt of the knife was him stabbing me in the head.
Yeah, but you punch harder than him, right?
That's right.
There you do.
That's right.
Yeah,
but when he stabbed me in the head, his hand slid. Because apparently, like, with a stabbing knife, which I didn't know that was a thing.
Yes.
The stabbing knife, there's a finger guard, so you won't... But when it hits your skull, you know, like something hard like your skull, his hand slid down.
Which is why...
he sliced his hand.
That's why he was on the ground.
That's why he was looking at his
hand. Okay, so just quickly for me. So he stabs you in the head. He stabbed you in the... He's cut the fingers and you don't know.
Yeah.
He got onto the floor because the knife cut him as he was stabbing.
No, she pushed him.
Feet up underneath him. He was like straddled on top of me this whole time while he was doing like bop, bop, punch, punch, punch. And like we were slashing at each other.
She brought her knees in for a curdle and pushed
and kicked him off of the bed.
Wow. Okay. So you okay?
She and took then, over.
Well, I'm like I've always been self-conscious about my tree trunk thighs, and this is when I was like, thank God for tree trunk thighs.
You better get them calves. Okay,
so he's on the floor looking at his hands.
So he's looking at his hands. I jump down. I'm punching and kicking him, screaming at him. He gets back up and has the knife in his hand again. Pushes me down onto the floor again, but this time I'm feral. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, get the fuck out of my house. I'm gonna fucking kill you. So I'm still coming at him. He slashed at me again, and I put my arms up, which I like, got cut on my arms.
The wolf.
So I'm fine with it. I have these arms today. They have some damage, but it was fine.
Yeah.
So I'm still screaming at him. Then all of us, and I'm still like, get the fuck out of my house. I'm fucking kill you. Get the fuck out of my house while he's doing that. Mm-hmm. And still punching him and going after him. And then all of a sudden I see him stand up and run away. And I remember thinking, okay, I guess we're running now. And so I got up and ran. And then you'll like this. This is vase adjacent.
That's everything, girl.
I got a lamp and pulled it out of the wall. It was like a glass vase lamp. Pulled it out of the wall, ran after him. He ran to the door. He was messing with the door. He couldn't get it open. So I was like, he didn't come in the door. But I hit him with the lamp and I get the fuck out of my house. I'm fucking killing you. Get the fuck out of my house. And then he got the lamp, hit me, like reached around behind himself, hit the lamp out of my hand. There was another lamp right by the door that had a heavy base. And I was like, that one has a heavy base. I'll pull that out of the wall, hit him with that.
Like that upside.
And then he got out and he ran.
I love you so much right now. Oh, I love you so much. First of all, let's go.
Oh, we're running now? Let's go.
It's yes. Like it's so satisfying. Thank you. I love this story. It's a scary story, but I love telling it because
I'm
we
so
win.
Proud of you.
And you're in this story, we win.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. You're a badass in this story, and that's why. Okay, but do we keep going? You have questions?
I have so many questions. Okay.
But we have limited time, and we have...
I know. So here's there's so much to your story, and I definitely want to save some for you. I want to kind of dive into it, because this is something that she and I both, like, talk about, right? And I kind of want to gear the conversation after we know your story.
Yeah.
Aftermath. You've already talked about the fact that sometimes you get up, you turn your head to the left and you feel that moment.
Ticks.
Mm-hmm. You have the ticks. You have, I'm sure, the ligaments in your fingers are now not usable or what the right word is. What are some other after effects that you go through on a day-by-day basis?
How long do we have?
That's what I'm saying.
How long do we have?
We got limited time.
I want to hear about the ones that have changed your life dramatically. Not the baby ones. I want to hear about the dramatic ones. And then I want you to tell me one that no one would ever think happens.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good question. I would say there is a cost. You know, of course, like, I didn't ask for this to happen to me, but it's a victorious story, and I get to come out swinging. There is a cost physically, emotionally, relationally, in how you like greet the world, the people that you love. Yeah, like
where the fuck am I living after this? Yeah.
And so there, you know, everything from that night forward, you know, as soon as he ran out the door, my life changed.
Yes.
And it wasn't something that I asked for, and it wasn't something that I consented to, and it was everything about my life. So it was the like massive amounts of change that I think ended up being very scary to me. And then also betrayal from people in my life. This man who attacked me, it was like, I didn't know him. He had been stalking me for a long time is what I ended up finding out. But I didn't feel any kind of betrayal from him. It was like the human contract, yes. But it was like a story that I understood. Man breaks in, you fight back. You chase after him, he stabs you. You know, like these things happened and I understood it. What ended up being really difficult was all the change, that plus all the change, and then compounded with this betrayal from my ex who ended up like displaying like narcissistic behavior, which had been going on for a long time.
And men were just doing you dirty left and right.
Yeah, it was like a 1-2 punch of like people you don't know and people you do know. And I think that started to really kind of reshape what does the world look like for me.
But do you use knives?
Wouldn't that be badass if I was like an expert at knife play? I didn't have knives in my house at all for like 2 years.
Okay.
I had a neighbor that brought over a big box of weapons. I slept there one more night and then had to move out.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I was dead set on going back to that apartment. But like a neighbor brought it, when I was there, brought over, like, I have this like baseball bat that's a taser, which is awesome. Nice.
Oh, I used to have one of those.
It's amazing.
So he was caught.
He was caught. Right. Like, 3 days later, he was arrested. It wasn't until after the trial that I found out that he had been watching me as long as he
can
had.
Can we talk about this for a second? Yeah. So tell us about the stalking and how that came to your knowledge and everything.
So that was like, of course, he breaks in, and in the days and nights afterward, I wondered, who was this man? You know, like, did he see me drive home from the salon that day? Was he just standing up at the bus stop? Had he been watching for 2 weeks? Had he been watching for 2 months? But then over time, that started to fade away, that wondering, because it was just like, I can't go there. I don't have those answers. And it was maybe, it was like July of 2018, the detective called me and said that someone had written a letter to the DA's office, someone that knew the man who attacked me. And in that letter, there were all these details that he couldn't share. But he asked me, one of the questions he asked was, have you ever been to Arizona? And I said, yes, this like kind of funny sounding town in Arizona. It's like Happy Arizona or something like that. The ex who I had moved to Los Angeles with, his family lived in a little town called Surprise, Arizona. And we had visited there right when we moved to LA. So in 2011, the attack happened in 2018. So fast forward years later, the trial has happened and they finally show me what's in the contents of this letter. They had debated whether or not it was going to be like a piece of evidence and whether or not they were going to charge him with something. They ended up not charging him with stalking, but they...
What'd they charge him with?
He was charged with intent to commit felony rape while in the commission of a burglary of the first degree. And that one was what carried a life sentence. And he was convicted on all of these in the trial. So he... Okay. He is in prison right now for life. I think it was life plus 3 years was what he got convicted of. So it's a little bit of like a fairy tale outcome as far as me surviving, him getting arrested right away.
You know, there's prison.
Not a fairy tale.
Did you call the cops that night?
So I called, first I called my ex, which I also don't recommend if you are in the middle of something like this. I tried calling him three times. He didn't answer. And then I called 911. And I've shared the 911 call on TikTok. I wasn't anticipating the reaction to the 911 call. I get transferred a couple times. And I think you can hear that I'm frustrated. And I was, you know, to be totally honest, to have to repeat myself. And I was, you know, when are you guys coming? Why am I saying my address for the third time? And they were kept saying, like, are you still bleeding? Are we helping you? And I was like, didn't want to lie. So I was like, I talked to her, but she didn't really help.
Oh, cops.
But, like, everybody is kind of reacting to that. But the police were there within like 3 minutes, I would say. So they were there pretty quick. And then they took me to the firefighters bandaged me up. They took me to the hospital. And then I was like under a secret code name at the hospital, which was nice. So I was very protected there. And family flew out from Wisconsin and stuff from there. Okay. But I do want to answer your question, too, about, the other charges were burglary, robbery, assault with a deadly weapon, mayhem, and then intent to commit
felony rape. But not stalking, which he actually was, then you found out later.
Yeah. For 7 years.
So
answer the question, though, you wanted to ask.
The one about, like, what's happening from an emotional standpoint. Yeah.
Because that was an interesting question, though, that you asked about, like,
what is the one thing that your body goes through that no one else think happens?
Yeah, because I think it's like there's the short term and then there's the long term of like
long COVID, man.
Yeah. It's like these things stick around in your body and they fuck around and they do crazy things that we can't anticipate and we don't really understand. But I think in the short term, it was obvious things. Like I had like access to rage was right under the surface. So I like told a story recently on the TikTok of like holding a glass like and someone said something that made me upset, and then I looked down and the wine glass was broken and I was bleeding and I didn't realize it. Like, it was just rage was that close. I would also run from restaurants or like run from places all of a sudden if something happened. So it was like extreme extended fight or flight that lasted for months. Then I started to experience like dissociation, extreme dissociation in the form of derealization, depersonalization.
Can you just break those words down?
Yeah, a lot of D words.
Yeah, a lot of them.
So dissociation, we kind of talked about, is like a separation of brain and body, kind of in a very basic sense. But there's physiological things or like neurobiological things that are happening in your brain that actually create this. It's not like you just are emotionally weak and so that's happening. That was something I needed to find out in my journey to get better. But depersonalization is like the double click into that, which is you start to believe, as a result of some of these brain functions not working properly or being offline, you start to believe that your reality is not real. So like, this is a dream, or I'm in hell, or I'm asleep, or this is another dimension.
That also happens with CPTSD. I have that as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have that as well.
And it could, for me, it could flip on and off. And I would say it was, for me, it was like familiarity. Like the room would all of a sudden, or the place I was would all of a sudden not be familiar. And it was so scary.
Yeah.
And did you sometimes find comfort in that? Like, I'm actually am in a dream.
Oh, yeah. Because it gave me the freedom to do anything that I felt. Anything that made me feel something different. And I was diving into addiction. I was drinking from morning until night. I was driving around Los Angeles while I was drinking. You know, like, I was wandering around parking lots, talking to people. And then the derealization is that. I think I messed those up. Depersonalization. Derealization is your environment. Depersonalization is yourself.
And it's interesting how, just when you were saying you would drive drunk or drinking or go to parks and kind of randomly talk to people or whatever it was, when people go through traumatic events, like you hear a lot of times that after a person has been raped, they will become heavily promiscuous. Yeah. Or they'll go the opposite direction, which is they'll kind of like completely go internal and big clothes and not want to be seen and not want to attract men at all. But it's just so interesting to me, again, how we choose to cope. And choose is a strong word, because I think a lot of this is actually subconscious.
It is subconscious.
And we're just like putting ourselves into these scenarios to try and challenge or fight the anger, fight the rage. And it's just, I mean, there's no real question there. It's simply just wild that this is what human beings go through.
Process to survive.
Speaking to you, so level-headed now, explaining the attack. And in the attack, you explained what your brain was doing. So conscious, so aware, so in the moment. And it's done, and you no longer have control of that. You just, your body chose, not you, your body chose to act out and do these things. Were you aware in your brain that the things that you were doing were a traumatic response? Or did you sink into that reality and say, I don't know why I'm doing this?
Absolutely. I was actively fighting against that. I was vulnerable to having any reaction at all to this. I'm fine. I just kept repeating to everyone, performing for everyone, showing up to brunch, even though my hair was cut with this little cut thing. And I had a black eye that lingered for 2 months and had all these cuts around my arms. And it was just like, I was trying so hard to make it seem like nothing had changed, because I didn't want all the change that was happening. And I wanted things to just go back to the night before this happened and be normal and be her again. And I felt like I was experiencing so much loss. So I was, I think the fighting against like having a reaction to this and like disallowing pain or grief or fear, it was what ended up pushing me into these dangerous situations that I ended up finding myself in the months afterward, where I was like going to bars to try to get in fights, because it was like,
because you're a badass.
Because I, but I was like,
being a badass.
Yeah,
I was like, couldn't process these feelings of like, I felt so like when I was standing over him, hitting him, all I wanted was dominance. I wanted him to hold still and me just to like, I didn't want to kill him. I just like, I would have, but all I wanted was just to be dominant over him holding still. But like that feeling, tapping into that feeling, it stays with you for a really long time.
Have you had issues with control?
Very much.
Before or after?
Very much after. So Another thing I experienced was ED for the first time. It's again like seeing all of these things in a vacuum of like, oh, that's why that happens. That's why that happens to human beings. Like, these are all coping mechanisms by your from your body and your brain trying to figure out what do we do to make this work.
And try and process emotion. It's so, again, it's so interesting to me because even somebody who hasn't been attacked in such a violent way can still have trauma that they still will try and process out in eating disorder or addiction or reckless behavior. And again, it's just like the human being and the brain and body only has so many outlets and so many ways to try and express itself or understand itself. And so much of this is so primal. It's so primal.
I have a question and I'm not going, I'm going to ask it, but then I'm going to pause.
Okay.
And you can say, don't fucking ask me that question. Move on. Okay. So I'm going to ask it. I'll just ask.
Okay.
Your body is fighting. Your brain is fighting. You are going, what happened to your, forgive me, but it just makes me want to ask, what happened to your sex drive after it? In your relationships, were you more dominant in that relationship afterwards? Were you more vulnerable? What was that
more
like?
Passive.
More passive? I was fawning. Because what was happening, and like, I would say one of the long-term changes that's happening is that 2 years after the attack, I was like, fine. You know, like having sex for me is totally fine. I don't mind being touched. Nothing has changed. Now, 6 years, almost 7 years out from the attack, I've been celibate for like over 2 years, which is something that I'm totally comfortable talking about because I think it's honestly helped me a lot. But coming out of that, and something I crave more than anything from the very second it happened is to be held. But now there's a grow as time goes on, a deepening fear of trusting human beings with touch or vulnerability. And so, like, you know, I love to like hug people, but like the idea of letting someone into my space or letting someone be that close to me, like emotionally, or even allowing someone to hold me or care for me is like, that's like a seed that got planted real deep that has started to sprout into a tree that is becoming a bigger force that I have to contend with than even like the other things that I was contending with right afterward, because it's so, it's like a, I heard someone say that trauma can cause like not a perspective shift, but like a redefining of a world,
a dimensional shift.
Like a new truth. And that to me is a new truth that I have to either accept or unwind.
Honestly, though, when it comes to sex, touch, intimacy, the act of sex is such a strong energy exchange. And obviously it's normal, right? People are accustomed to having sex. We are inundated with sex in our imaging all day and in our society. But when you actually, again, look at what it is
an energy of a woman's body.
Yeah, but it's, yeah, it's an invasion to an extent, but it's this energy change. It's this letting in. And again, it's super primal. And everything that you essentially experience and having to defend yourself and fight for yourself came from that same primal response.
Yeah.
And I can understand how, as
if
time,
you want to sit on top of a man and choke the fuck out of him while he, that's okay for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can understand how.
And then I'm like, get the fuck out of my house.
Oh my God.
You finish your day, girl. You get your life.
So mad at you.
I'm sorry.
You can't interrupt me.
I mean, honey, I'm trying to.
I'm right here. I'm right here with you.
I'm not here anymore because my thoughts are that they go that quick. So,
but no, I hear what you're saying though. I think it is, there's all of these very human things that come out of a story like this that, you know, like I don't think that man's touch, because it wasn't coming from a place of sexuality, it wasn't coming from a place of energy exchange.
Right.
It was coming from a place of violence. Mm-hmm. You know, like his touch was not about sex, it was about power. And I think because I wasn't raped, which also the his defense attorney, like that was her closing argument, like if he wanted to rape her, he would have raped her.
Not a girl.
I know. Not well, she ended up leveling with me afterward and she was very kind and we had exchanged kind words. Okay. But I mean, she was like, she was doing what she had to do. But then the prosecutor, the assistant DA, had a rebuttal to her closing remarks and was like, he didn't rape her because she fought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would have.
He would have raped you.
Did you ever see him again?
I did.
You did. And what was that like? And where was that?
That was at the preliminary hearing, which is just kind of right before the trial. They'll have a preliminary hearing. Both of the attorneys will share all of their evidence with the judge, and the judge will decide whether or not you have enough evidence to actually go to trial. At the preliminary hearing, my family all flew in. It was really like a long process to get the preliminary hearing for multiple reasons, but it was 2018, February, the attack happened. The next time I saw him was Halloween. 2020.
My Halloween.
2019
before the, yeah, it was, yep, before the
before COVID. The pandemic. I know, I was like, why does it have to be that?
I know, Halloween is usually such a great day. That's, I know, no, really awful
coded. But so it was Halloween 2019, and my family came in. We were like sitting in the airport courthouse down in like Torrance area in LA. And we were sitting there in the back, and it was a busy courtroom, so he didn't know I was there. Mm. And they brought him in. There were like a bunch of other cases. We were just kind of in the room watching. It was open. And then they brought him in, and he was, I just remember thinking he was really tall. And I knew he was tall, but he was like 6'2", 6'3". He looked really skinny, I remember thinking, compared to the last time I saw him. And his skin looked really sallow. Like he looked kind of sick. And then once he did know I was there, like once they brought me up onto the stand to testify, because I was the only eyewitness.
What
was the
look? What look did he give you?
I was too scared to look at him at first. Okay. So I was just looking at my family in the back, and I was like, my body could sense that he was near. And so my body was reacting almost kind of similar to like the body reaction I have telling the story of like that. But they also seat him right across from you.
I can't stand the judicial system. So sometimes. Strange. It's so weird.
So I got a couple minutes, like 2 minutes into the, or I introduced myself and spelled my name, and he started yelling, "That's not Caroline. That's not Caroline. That's an actress. That's an actress. That's not her. That's not her." And I was like,
"What's going on?
Fuck?
Yeah.
Like, what? Who's Caroline?" So this ended up being a process. I came back in. They took me out. I came back in. He had promised to be calm. Then I started saying my testimony again. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, did he get the wrong girl? Who's Caroline? And then he started saying, he stood up and was like, Motorola is in charge. Motorola and Facebook.
And you are like, not getting the insanity plea, dumbass.
Then it was like, okay, now you're like, conspiracies. Got it. But then he wouldn't let us get through the testimony. He just kept talking, and he was talking to me. And he, like, at one point, the DA was asking if I had, she was like, you have a scar on your neck from where the knife was, right? And I said, yes. And the judge asked if I could turn and show her. And he yelled out, take off your shirt. Show us your scars. Pull down your shirt. She's lying. She's lying. So it was like, not fun.
So he's unhinged.
He's a mess.
So I remember him being very clear. And that was like, I was wondering, questioning myself. When he left the courtroom that day, he said to a bailiff, and then this became part of like the trial. He said to the bailiff, how did I do? Was that an Oscar-worthy performance? So he like, he's not super smart. Like, don't tell the bailiff. But
he disgusts me. I don't even want to talk about him. I honestly, I don't. He's deplorable. Your mom. Mm. Your dad.
Your brothers.
Mm-hmm. Your brothers. You go to the cops. You call after that night. Mm-hmm. Did you make the call to them first, or did the cops make the call to them first?
Thinking about when I talk to my mom, is such a, I like, I'm very protective of my mom. Like, I've always kind of seen myself as her protector. Mm. And I remember I was in the ER, and I was in a really bright room, and there was like 15 people touching me. Mm. And there's pictures of me at that moment. I'm gone. Like, I knew I was safe, but also I was scared because I was being touched by so many people. And they cut off my clothes, and
it's more invasive,
It was more invasive than what actually ended up happening to me that night, which they were trying to save me, and that's their job. Mm-hmm. But a social worker came in, asked for my mom's phone number, who I wanted to call, and she held up the phone while I could hear my mom talking, and we only got to say to each other, I said, hi, Mom, and she said, hi, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. She said, I'm coming. And then the social worker took the phone out. So then she came, and like, I think I just always say, like, if this happened to me, it happened to my mom too. Yeah. More, you know, like
her baby.
Yeah, she. Yeah. It's every mom's, it's every woman's worst nightmare, and it's every mother's worst nightmare. So, she, I think, she's never gone to therapy. She, you know, like, she hasn't really processed everything to the level that I have. I've gone to EMDR therapy, cognitive therapy. Mm. I've, you know, written about this experience, and I think that also kind of helps with processing. Yeah, for sure. Just being creative with the story in any capacity for me helps me embody it more.
Mm-hmm. Especially since you're creative. Now, knowing that you have this background in acting and art and you know, it makes so much sense, and also makes so much sense as to why you're so compelling in telling this story. Like, thank you. Those lights all connected for me. I just want to know, how are you doing today? What does life look like? How's Cookie? Are you working?
Do you have knives?
I do.
Do your pillow?
No.
She has a machete underneath hers.
You know how many women I've talked to? Okay. So the amount of women that I've talked to that when I ask them if they have a weapon in their house, I'd say, I have not just a knife, a machete.
I have a machete.
I would say, and a burner. Men, any men that are listening or any men that are thinking about maybe like learning from this interview, all women have machetes under their pillows. Like 80% of women. Like, so many.
I will not. I will continue. The question was for you.
But no, I have my big baseball bat, my taser baseball bat. But Cookie's doing really well. Cookie just had her 16th birthday. She's a Virgo. So she's, and she's like, she can't hear for nothing. So I had to yell. I had to lift up her ear flap on the way here. I was like, Cookie,
I'm leaving.
I'll be back. So she's in her, you know, senior years. Mm. Bless her heart. But I'm doing well. I think it's been a transition for sure, and a positive one, nothing but a positive one, to go from, I would say, 2.5, 3 months ago, I was trying to, like, I was writing out letters to literary agents and stuff, trying to get someone to pay attention to the story. Like I said, I think I told you guys earlier that I hadn't been received very well by a lot of women in my life at the time after the attack, which then caused me to really question whether or not I should tell this story, which comes out still to this day. Like, am I being bad by telling this story? Because a lot of women were like, you made me stay up all night, or this is too scary, or you're heightening our cortisol.
Go sit down.
And it's like, I was feeling like compelled. Like, I had, like, this is, there's a, I don't know what that movie, I forget. The Family Stone. Have you guys ever seen that Christmas movie?
Yeah.
And I think it's Dermot Mulroney is walking with Claire Danes, and he said, like, she's talking about, like, she went to go see this tribe and in Alaska, I think, maybe, and they carve, this artist carved something out of wood, and he said, I just saw it in the wood, and I couldn't not carve it. And so that is how I felt these last 2 years. Like, I can't not tell this story, but everyone's telling me I'm bad. So then I started, and I work full time. I work as a VP of creative for a dog food company. So if you guys ever need anything for Quinn. If I would have known, I would have brought you guys a bunch of stuff.
So cute.
We just had a dog costume party last weekend.
For Halloween?
For Halloween.
I'm so jealous. I wanted to dress our dog.
It's
so
like
bad.
Planning photo shoots for dogs is my favorite thing in the world. Yeah. Like, what costume are they going to wear?
Amazing.
But so that's, you know, like, that's all working and that's all in place. I will say, like, working is sometimes really hard. I think I obsess and, like, get very obsessive about work to not think about other things, and I'll sometimes really disconnect from self-care, which I think is still persisting from the attack and from the PTSD.
You know, in our society now, there's kind of a double-edged sword telling your story, and it is one, we need it. We need to inform, we need to show community and, you know, support you in all the ways. But then there's also the other side where telling such a tremendous story can become your identity to the public.
Yeah.
And it's not fair and it's not okay that that will and is right now the energy that surrounds you. How do you feel about that? And I know you're succeeding. You know what I mean? You're very successful in the sense of you can sit here with us and not have an aide in the other room giving you a Xanax. We might take them, and that's okay if you do.
No,
but you know what I mean? Like, you're not having
I'm not against them. You know? It's a party. Okay.
But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. you're well composed as of right mm-hmm. now.
Thank you.
I don't want this to become your identity to the people that are watching.
That's, thank you for saying that. And that's something that I want, and I'm trying as hard as I can with every creative muscle in my body to prevent, because I do, like, something I'm really passionate about is victims telling their own stories. Like, mm-hmm. instead of a third party telling your story, if it comes right from me, you're going to get these little nuggets of truth that maybe resonate with you in a really human way that might get washed away when it's being told by someone else.
Or a man.
Or a man. Damn men.
Sorry.
Source of problem. But I think in telling this story, it's like I want people to see all these shades of a mm-hmm. human being, in that, you know, I was a girl who had a dream and came to California and believed in something and then got lost in a relationship. And then this happened and I had to rediscover that feral little kid that I was once. And through, like, the aftermath of all the mental health challenges that come with that and the, like, all the betrayal and stuff that I experienced in relationships, what comes out of that is someone who's able to speak and who, like, has really centered themselves in that person that they really are. And to me, I feel very lucky to be someone who isn't, I'm not very private at all. Like, I'll tell anybody anything. And I also, like, I get nervous about speaking, but I'll speak. Mm-hmm. So I think some survivors don't have that storytelling ability. Urge, yeah. And some survivors want to tell their story through drawings, or they want to tell their story through writing, or they want to, but they don't want to be very visible. And also, a lot of women are very scared for me in the comments, saying, like, be careful, you know, like, someone's going to come after you. And I am aware of that, but it's that balance of, like, mm-hmm. I'm willing to take that risk to tell this story, to hopefully, because when I'm feeling like I can't find the story, or when I'm feeling like maybe I shouldn't be telling the story, I just remind myself of the girl 6 months out from the attack that needed it, that was alone and couldn't find her story somewhere to know what to do, know if she's going to be okay, know what's to come. Mm. And I just keep telling myself, like, if there was one girl that needed it, it was her. And so if this story finds her in whatever way, whatever time, whatever place, that means that it was worth it. But I mean, I do have to balance, like, the safety aspect.
And also, I totally understand what you're saying, right? Like, you don't want to be essentially, like, typecast as mm-hmm. one thing. But anyone who also understands being a person, you know yeah. that you are not just one thing. And yes, publicly, maybe, but we all have different journeys and roads into becoming.
Yeah.
And I think that yours, it was, you know, there was an inciting incident that was extraordinarily violent and terrifying. And people, because of the shock value, will attach their own, and they'll have perceptions of what this means or what they would do in that situation. But, you know, I have had my own more private road of towards becoming, right? And mm-hmm. it's still traumatic and hard, and people publicly will see me as one thing and her as one thing and you as another, but that's just what this world does. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I think that the fact that you've been bold and brave enough to share your story and continue to fight, you're still fighting in a way, you know what I mean? Because in giving women a role model, and you're saying, you know, you can be strong and you can share your story, and this is only a result of what someone else did to you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing too. That's so wild. Another human being inflicted this on you. So,
and now you're that girl in Wisconsin that you have. And I think that, you know, I kind of want to talk to the women before we ask you another question that are shaming you for telling your story and living in that don't speak. No, I think they should shut the fuck up, because the problem is because of the female culture of so mindful, so demure and quiet, we get walked on, we get trampled over, and sometimes we have to jump on top yeah. of the attacker and yeah. strangle them and punch the fuck out of them. Yeah. And we the do. Strength does not mean less femininity. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you have to do it like a man does. It just means that you have that strength. That's why lionesses are mm-hmm. there to fight along the with the lion. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? They're the
that's
hunters.
That's why women lift cars to save their babies. I mean, there
you know
are...
What I mean? That's what, like, that... like the bringing out the fight in women and encouraging the fight in women and encouraging ferocity and not looking at it as a borrowed trait from men. You know, like we have an internal ferocity that has a reason. This is the reason, you know?
That's the reason.
And like, you don't have to fight. Like your body will intuit what your best mm-hmm. approach is if you're in a dangerous situation. So if you fight, flight, freeze, fawn, all of those are brilliant. Use those. Use all of them.
Let me just say this. And I think what happened is that there are certain men in our society that put the cap on us mm-hmm. and made us for so long think that we're supposed to be so shy and demure.
They're out there for sure.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not a natural thing for a woman mm-hmm. to be so quiet. We fight for the ones that
they've
we love.
Socialized it out of us.
Sorry, baby.
No, it's fine. I was just going to say, I know your approach to those people is like, shut the fuck up, sit down. My thing is, I want to meet you with curiosity.
Yeah.
Why would your response to someone else telling their truth and their story be to tell them to stop? You know, what is it triggering in you that's so scary mm-hmm. or so foreign that you don't know how to meet it with, I mean, compassion, understanding, or just turning away from it? Because if it doesn't, it's not being forced upon you. So I think for me, I'm more interested in what certain conversations bring up and out in other people, especially when there's discomfort, especially when you're met with anger, especially when you're met with intense emotion. Because to me, that's the greatest indicator that that is some unhealed element in that you. Being. And ultimately, it's not my responsibility to fix that.
Exactly.
It's not yours.
So shit, shut the fuck up and sit down.
But just go figure yourself out. You know, understand. Like every time that I hear something and I start to panic or I start to feel some type of way, I assess and I go, what's happening to me right now? Am I just so in it because
and having
I'm
a self curiosity?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, how we can all become better humans too, and
absolutely.
Better interactors and communicators with others. So
I do think, to add to what you said, you know, I think that like there's an initial response to the story, if it scares you and if it's not something you've ever experienced, if you've never felt in danger, if you've never been sexually assaulted, if you've never been raped, like I know most of the women in my life have experienced something like this in some shade. If you've never experienced and your response is immediately like, that's too scary, you know, like, I don't want that. That to me, there's like, yes, I want to respect your boundary. On the other hand,
you gotta live in reality.
There's a generosity of spirit in saying like, I can hear your story, but let me get settled into a place mm-hmm. where I feel safe. Mm-hmm. Or saying like, I would love to hear your story, but can I, you know, like, can I skip the parts that are really scary, but really focus on like healing and being there for you and how that showed up for you? Mm-hmm. I think all those things are okay, because I think I also do think that it was so prevalent after the attack, and I was acting out in these big ways. You know, I was screaming, I was running, I was yelling, I was reacting, I was breaking. You know, there were big things. And I think we are in kind of a general sense socialized as women to swallow. We're mm-hmm. socialized to be small. We're socialized to contain. We're socialized to prioritize the comfort of other people. And so for me to act out in these big ways and take up the space and mm-hmm. roar and have a reaction was a lot of the women in my life, I think, trying to protect me. I'm doing air quotes in saying, no, 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 that's not for us. We have to swallow it. We have to stay small.
You got to come over here to my culture, honey. We don't do that. We don't do that over here. All
that's
right?
Like the Wisconsin. Like,
that's the Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
White girl. No,
I love Wisconsin.
Midwest.
I love Wisconsin, but that is like, you contain it. You make it small. You don't tell your neighbor. It's very kind of like,
yeah,
be tiny. Don't have needs. Don't take up space. And so that, I think, you know, is a kind of a cuddled reaction of safety that backfired.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take up space, and you're going to continue taking up space, because you're amazing.
You deserve
and
it.
Yeah, extraordinarily worthy.
You deserve space.
Thank you,
and
guys.
Extraordinarily strong. And thank you for taking time today to share your story with us and all of our listeners.
Be
yeah,
thank
obviously,
you. Let's be
obviously. We're going to be real tea
and
party friends.
And cooking.
Yeah. Let's cheers. Yeah,
cheers. Thank you for having me.
I really
appreciate it. And thank you for the thoughtful questions and for being generous and just really kind of diving into what this really means beyond, you know, the salacious, scary story. I really
means
do
a lot.
Appreciate
it. Yeah, it means a lot. You're changing lives.